this point, you're running up against the clock. Tax returns must be received or postmarked by Tuesday, April 17th. And if you need an extension, you can request that from the IRS before that April 17th deadline. Taxes on your mind and on our mind on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is our guide. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Hi there, Kevin. Are you there,
Kate.
Kevin? Hi there. All right. I just got the end of Kate, but you are on. And if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, call it in at 800-642-1234. You can ship it to us in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So tax deadline day right around the corner, Kevin. We have some tax facts that may or may not make you feel better about filing.
Did you get yours in yet, Kate?
Yes, of course. Did you ever doubt me, Kevin?
I like that you say, of course. Like, yeah, we thought about it. And then we said, you know what? Let's do it this year. I feel good about our situation. I feel good about America. Well, Kate, you're not alone because 155 million other individual returns are being filed for the 2017 tax year. 90% of them will be filed electronically. And filing electronically is a good idea because it allows you to get your refund faster. And it's more likely that your numbers are correct, which we'll talk about in a minute here. The time that it takes to complete your taxes for an individual, according to the good people at the IRS, it takes 13 hours of work to complete an individual taxes. But the Tax Foundation says that's not true. It takes 27.5 hours in their estimate in terms of not only keeping the information, but tracking it during the year, then finally filing it, and then sending the information in.
That's a lot of time. Why is tax filing so complicated?
Because politicians get involved in it. The first forms were actually not a whole lot different in 1913 when the first federal income tax returns were required from individuals, but only about 4% of people had to pay taxes at that time due to huge exemptions. They were about $3,000 for singles and $4,000 for married couples filing jointly. That might not sound like a lot, but 105 years ago, it was a lot of money, so most people did not have to pay income taxes. And now, as we mentioned, 155 million people filing. But what really makes it complex is all the lobbying that goes into Washington and Madison and all the other state capitals around the country is there are changes made to the tax code every single year. And sometimes they're for good reasons, other times they're for not so good reasons. They're designed to favor certain activities or groups, or they're designed to punish certain activities or groups by adding taxes on top of it. And for politicians, it's if they don't change the tax code, there's really not a whole lot else that they can do that shows that they're actually working for their constituents or at least the people who voted for them.
So how much money is raised then from the individual income tax?
The Office of Management and Budget says in 2017, we're going to kick in about $1.66 trillion as individuals. That's a little over 48% of all federal tax revenue. About all of us pay a little bit in taxes in some way, shape, or form, but most of us don't pay very much in federal income taxes. About 43% of federal income taxpayers pay only 1.4% of that $1.66 trillion, according to 2015's numbers. But the average federal income tax bill each year is about $10,000 or so. That's still a lot of money, but it works out to an average effective tax rate of about 13.5%. That, of course, includes single filers and married couples filing jointly, households. So it works out to about $80,000, give or take, of gross income. And you hear a lot about people saying, well, they're in a 40 or 50% income tax bracket. That might be true for certain portions of their income, especially if they lose out on some deductions. But on average, usually only the maximum effective tax rate, meaning how much a percentage of income goes towards taxes, even for those people who make hundreds of millions of dollars, it's usually only about 30% of their income goes towards federal income taxes.
And what are our chances, then, of being audited by the IRS?
Why do you ask?
Just asking. It's a question.
Oh, okay, good. Well, it's for you, it's extremely low because I'm sure you're very diligent and report all of your earned and taxable income. But for the rest of us, it's low and getting lower. Right now, the odds of an individual income tax return getting an audit are about 1 in 160, and that compares to 1 in 90 in 2011, about 6 years ago. Things that can increase your odds of getting audited are, first of all, if you try to declare a deduction for a home office or a car. Or let's say you go to Cancun for a week and you say it was a business trip. That might trigger a flag where the agents say, hey, we want to take a look at this and see if you really did do business down there. Otherwise, you can't deduct your kids' water slide passes on that trip. One thing that's easy to avoid for a red flag that triggers some increased scrutiny by the state and federal auditors is if your math doesn't add up. And that's less likely to happen when you file electronically, because usually there's a software system that says, hey, you didn't carry the 7, and therefore your math doesn't add up. Where are we wrong here? And then you can go back in and correct the math. So that's a good reason to use a tax service and to file electronically.
Kevin McKinley is managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast, does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. You can join in with your personal finance question that's on your mind, perhaps keeping you up at night. 800-642-1234. Send it by email to onyourmoney@ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Christina now in Glenwood. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Oh, thank you, wise one. suggested that I open an HSA before we file our taxes this year, and he said we could go back 24 months, so I can use 2016, 2017, and my bank is unclear about the 2016.
Yeah, I've never heard that before. I defer to the expertise of your tax preparer. And it sounds like you've actually dove into this already, Christina, because you understand sometimes what tax preparers say, you know what, you can make a 2017 and a 2018 HSA or IRA contribution, because usually once January 1st of the year rolls around, that's your first opportunity to prepare. But it sounds like you've looked into it. I'm not sure that you can do that. I'm going to check into it, because that's an interesting strategy. Is this a tax preparer you've used before?
It is.
Okay. And you've been confident otherwise in his or her skills?
Well, I guess I question the 2016.
Yeah, that's the only thing I'm concerned about. You obviously can do a 2017 one before April 17th of this year, but it's the 2016 one that I'm not familiar with. So I'd be cautious about that. And maybe you want to bounce it off of the HSA provider that you're using and calling up and say, hey, can I make a 2016 contribution? And they would probably know better than either me or the tax preparer.
And HSA refers to health savings account.
Yes. See, look, you can now do this show, Kate, yourself.
Well, just make clarifying those acronyms that can always trip people up. Christina, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Bob now in Cedarburg. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Good morning to you, Kate, and of course, Kevin. He is the guru.
Hi, Bob.
Good morning. My question to you is, listening to your suggestions and advice over the years, a group of us fellows do it collectively, and we've amassed a good sum of money in excess of $1 million in our retirement accounts, and we're all going into retirement, and none of us really need the RMDs that are coming out. So we're questioning, should we consider converting some of our IRA money, or most of it that we can, and stay in the 22 and even the 24% tax bracket today? Because we have that five-year window, and we're wondering what's going to happen in 5 years. Should we all live that long? What the interest rates might do then. And so the tax code could change, and we could be in a 40% tax bracket. Gee, we should have done this.
Yeah.
To go.
Bob, you hit on the exact point of this conundrum, which is, the notion is, do you take money out of an IRA that you technically don't need to live on, and then you can move it into a Roth IRA, and you pay taxes on it, or at least it's taxable as ordinary income. But the good news is once you make the conversion, then the future earnings are still sheltered from taxation. There is no mandatory distribution at age 70 and a half from a Roth IRA. And if you do pull it out, it's tax-free. So Your point is salient in saying, where am I going to be hit at this on the tax bracket? And right now, I do think that federal income tax brackets are relatively low and may go higher. I don't think it's going to be 40%. Nobody pays 40% on their overall income, regardless of how much you calculate. And a good rule of thumb, Bob, is to say, if I'm a married couple filing jointly, I want to keep my gross income under $100,000, because that will probably keep me in the 22% or below the top of the 12% federal income tax bracket and from going into the 22% federal income tax bracket. If you're a single filer, it's about half that. Now, that can be different based on your situation, how many kids you have, deductions, et cetera. But with these new tax laws, your standard deduction goes to $12,000 and $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. So there's a good chance that you're probably going to be under that 12% federal income tax bracket ceiling as long as you keep your gross income to about $100,000 and half that if you're a single filer. And the bad news about doing that, Bob, is that in previous years, you could make a conversion from an IRA to a Roth IRA and then do your taxes the subsequent April. And if you didn't like the way the conversion affected your taxes, you could undo it. You could do what's called a recharacterization. That's been taken away in this recent tax changes. So if you do it, you want to do it probably later in the year because you'll have a better idea of where your taxes are actually going to be because you don't get that do-over in April like you once previously had.
Bob, thanks so much for the question. Kevin, we get a lot of questions about taxes this time of year, especially right now. So let's answer some of the ones that are most frequently asked, starting with, why are my taxes due on April 17th instead of April 15th?
Yeah, that seems strange, but it pops up every once in a while. The reason being is that, first of all, the 15th is on a Sunday in 2018. That's a weekend. And then the 16th is a holiday. It's Emancipation Day, which celebrates the abolition of slavery in Washington, D.C. So with Washington, D.C. on a holiday, they say, well, we can't accept your taxes on this particular day, so we're going to give you one extra day to file it after that. But the taxes do have to be filed by April 17th. They have to be postmarked by midnight, and usually there's a standard local news story where they put a camera and a person with a microphone standing by the mailbox at 10 p.m. as they watch people drive by and hurriedly throw in their returns into the box trying to beat the deadline.
Well, that was the day before the Internet took over our taxes.
Right.
What if I don't file my taxes on time?
Yeah, it's actually more common than people might think. If you're getting a refund and you never file your taxes, you could lose the refund if you don't file within 3 years. But if you owe money, of course, that's where the trouble starts. You can get hit starting with a 5% penalty. So if you owe $5,000, it's a $250 penalty if you don't file, and up to 25% of the amount owed can be hit. You might get some interest on top of that. The IRS has a provision where they can actually take the data on you that they have that's been submitted to them and file your taxes for you. That sounds like a good deal, but they probably will miss out on some deductions that you otherwise would have received, and it may end up costing you more money in taxes. And then if you don't file at all, you may miss out on some other ways. For instance, you might need your returns to get a loan, like a mortgage, or if you're applying for financial aid for school, or if you're older and you're applying for other kinds of eligibility benefits. Many times, those programs rely on a person's tax returns as the basis on which to decide if their income justifies getting those benefits.
And what if you owe the IRS or the state money, but you can't afford to pay it?
Again, not as uncommon as we might think. People just don't have enough withheld during the year, or they have some special event that they didn't count on and end up owing a bunch of money that they really don't have. You still should file. The penalties for not filing can be bigger, actually, than by paying late. And be proactive with the IRS or the State Revenue Department and say, hey, I just can't pay for this. What are my options? And they'll tell you, well, pay what you can now, and then we'll work out a payment plan for you. And they do that through their tax advocacy program. And you can get more information on it at irs.gov or by calling 800-829-1040. 800-829-1040. So again, if you're having trouble, at least file and put in what you can and then call that number and say, I understand that I'm going to have to pay these taxes. How can we set up a payment plan? Might get charged a little bit of interest, but it's better than just ignoring the problem and waiting till it festers, because they will eventually find you.
taxes, they've been on our mind for this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley can feel it. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a personal finance question, join in at 800-642-1234. Send it our way via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll have more smart tax moves coming up in just a bit. Stay with us for more On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. Are you a procrastinator who waits until the very last moment to file your taxes? Thanks to Emancipation Day, the filing deadline is April 17th to file your taxes, and that gives you a little more time to consider last-minute ways to lower your taxes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is running interference for you with some tax-wise investment moves. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a money question that's on your mind, ask away at 800-642-1234. You can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Tiffany now, who's waiting in La Crosse. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say thank you guys so much, because I realized today that I get most of my financial advice from this morning's show. I'm contemplating getting a new car. I called in a long time ago. I had just gotten a new car, and, you know, my interest rate is still kind of high, but now I've realized that 2 years into my car loan that we have outgrown our vehicle, and I'm very ill prepared. Like, I have no idea what to do. Can I go with half a paid loan back to my car dealership and try to refinance or get a different, bigger vehicle?
Yeah, Tiffany, you didn't make the mistake of buying a clown car or one of those Shriner cars that would drive around the parades. Okay,
no,
good.
It's a beautiful little Toyota Camry, but you know, it's not super old, but it doesn't have the wonderful safety features that newer cars have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the blind spot monitoring, the backup cameras, and all of those really great things that you want with a family. I'm not a crazy driver, but those are bonuses.
Yeah, they are. Would you probably move up to some kind of an SUV or a minivan?
Yeah, I'm thinking a crossover. Thankfully, we're not minivan ready yet.
What? Okay, back up for a second, Tiffany. What's wrong with minivans?
Yeah.
Not a single thing.
All right, good, because it's just a proof that you're old and you're stable and you're a family unit and everything when you have a minivan. It's just the acceptance of saying, okay, my own needs to be cool and look cool to random strangers in traffic have been subjugated by a vehicle that has a baby on board sign on the back of it.
I have to drive a minivan for work. The company I work for loves their Dodge minivans.
Mm-hmm.
And they are great. They are great. But the payments on those, I've noticed, are a little higher. So
Right. Maybe
for financial reasons, I'm not minivan ready.
Okay. Well, I like the idea of the crossover. A lot of the people I work with in my grown-up day job have one version of the Subaru Outback or a Toyota RAV4 or a Honda CR-V. And those are very sensible crossovers that are relatively affordable. Usually they top out at around $30,000 to $32,000 brand new, but they hold their value extremely well, and they don't depreciate as much, and they don't have a lot of repairs. They're generally rated very highly by Consumer Reports and other in-depth studies of vehicles. So I think it's fine to do that. And the good news is, Tiffany, is that you said you have a Toyota Camry?
I do, yep.
Okay, those vehicles also tend to hold their value pretty well, so it makes it less likely that you're upside down on your loan, meaning that you owe more money on the vehicle than it's actually worth. And car dealerships get paid a lot more when people make transactions on their vehicles. They make money from their service departments, et cetera, but they really like to get people coming in and trading in vehicles. And with the advent of 60-month and even 72-month loans, it's more common that people come in your situation saying, look, we just need a new new car, but we still owe money on the old one. So I would go to the dealership first. And to be honest with you, they're usually kind of surprised, especially with younger people. And by younger, I mean under 40, who are, first of all, interested in buying a car. And second of all, who aren't upside down or at least have a loan outstanding on the previous vehicle. So they'll be very glad to see you. Just make sure you pay attention to all the numbers in terms of what you're getting for the old vehicle, how much it's going to, how that compares to what the actual Blue Book value might be. You might be able to get more if you sell it on your own. And then don't talk about that car until you figure out what it is you're actually going to buy first. And then, and only then, talk about financing and talk about trading in your old vehicle. Because again, you don't want to, the dealership will be actually very happy to take your vehicle, because dealers usually make a greater percentage profit on used vehicles, selling them, than they do on new vehicles. And so they're very happy to do that. But just be very cautious about the procession of how you move from buying the car and then talking about financing and then talking about trading the vehicle in as well. But otherwise, yeah, I don't think you should have any problem at all.
Tiffany, thanks for the call. Minivans, they'll grow on you. Let's go to Devin now, joining us from Portage. Hi, Devin.
Hi there. I had a question about Devin travel for work and live in a camper, and I make a payment on every month. Is that something I can write off, like fuel and lodging? And,
yeah, Devin, is it
over there? Anything like that?
Do you use it just for, like, the camper just for work purposes, or do you also use it for taking hunting or on vacation or fishing?
No, just for work.
Okay. Yeah, then generally you can deduct a lot of the expenses of that. And again, you have to have enough expenses so that it can exceed what the standard deduction is before it makes sense to do that. But when you get to the internet, Devin, remember these three numbers, 511. And if you Google IRS and then 511, that'll give you the tax topic that'll tell you all the different travel expenses that you can deduct, and give you a whole listing, and then you can go through it and figure out what may be deductible for those particular costs. Again, you have to have enough expenses to exceed the standard deduction. Otherwise, the standard one just makes better sense to take that. But we'll put a link up to the direct tax topic, 511, at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Devin, thanks for the call. Mike in Madison is next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. I had a question. I recently started a 401k with my employer, and their share is regular 401k. My share is Roth 401k. I also have a Roth IRA. I was just wondering, what's the contribution limit since I have both a Roth 401k and a Roth IRA?
Now, you can generally, Mike, put in you can put in the maximum amount allowed. The usually it's the lesser of your income, or $18,000 and $24,000 if you're over 50 to the Roth 401k, and then for Roth IRA, it's $5,500 if you're under 50 and $6,500 if you're over 50. My question to you, Mike, is not if you can do it, but if you should. What I would prefer that most people do is max out their pre-tax contributions, like the pre-tax 401k or 403b at work, to the greatest extent possible. And then any extra savings that they have left over, if they qualify, put that into the Roth IRA. Because most people, Mike, are in a lower income tax bracket when they are retired than when they are working. And if that's the case, then you're better off deferring the taxes now and paying them later. And especially if you live a relatively frugal lifestyle in retirement, oftentimes people pay little or no federal income taxes at all, not much more in state taxes. And so in that case, it's better to defer the taxes today. Sometimes, and we'll talk about this in a few weeks, but sometimes we've seen studies where it says, no, the Roth is actually better than the pre-tax one. Well, the reason it works out better is because people kind of unknowingly end up paying their extra tax bill, meaning that if you put $5,000 into a Roth, that doesn't help your taxable income at all. So you might pay an extra $1,000 in income taxes. Well, so you've actually contributed $6,000 to your retirement savings, $5,000 for the contribution, then another $1,000 for taxes that you otherwise wouldn't have had to pay. And again, that it always works out to you. Tell me what the rate is that you're going to be taxed on it now versus retirement. And if it's higher while you're working than it is when you're retiring, you're better off doing the pre-tax plan today and then paying a little in taxes on it when you retire.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. We've been covering tax-related financial moves that need to be made before certain deadlines. What's today's topic, Kevin?
Today's topic one is a little bit esoteric, but I know our audience well enough that they will be interested in this. This is investment management fees. These are the fees that if you pay, let's say, 1% of your assets to a financial advisor who doesn't charge you any extra big commissions on top of it to buy and sell securities, but just gets reimbursed through that 1%, let's say, it can be tax deductible for the 2017 tax year if you pay it by check or if it's withdrawn from the account, and then to the extent it's added into your miscellaneous itemized deductions, and anything that's over 2% of your adjusted gross income is tax deductible. Some people don't know about that. They've been missing out on a tax break if that's the case. But that is only through the 2017 tax year. So any investment management fees you incurred through December 31st of last year.
So there's no way to save on taxes for investment management fees now?
Actually, there's still one way, and this has been true, but this is the only way now that you can do it. You can pull the fees tax-free from your IRA, but it's only for your IRA. It doesn't make sense for Roth IRAs. And the great thing is you don't need to itemize. You don't need to worry about deductions. If you say, well, I have $100,000 in an IRA, I pay a person to manage it for me 1% per year. And then when they pull that $1,000 out, they can pull it out tax-free from the IRA. But you have to make sure that you contact the advisor. It's up to you to tell the advisor that you want it done that way.
So do you think that's a good way to pay?
Yeah, sometimes it's hard for people to wrap their heads around, but it's just like any other expense you incur. For instance, if I said to you, you know, your utility bill is $200 a month, but if you pull that money from your IRA, you don't pay any taxes on the distribution from the IRA. Well, most people would jump on that. So the investment management fees are something you incur for a service you're getting. Pulling it from your IRA instead of writing the check going forward from 2018 on saves you about 10 to almost 40% of the cost, depending on the tax rate at which you would otherwise be hit when you pull the money out of the IRA in the future. And again, that does depend on your income tax bracket.
So why wouldn't someone who is otherwise eligible take advantage of this?
Well, there is a case to be saying, well, I think that money's going to grow more, and so I want to leave whatever I can in the tax-sheltered account so that it can hopefully grow more. And there's some case to be made for that. But there's other people just like the idea of writing a check for, getting the invoice or whatever they have, but it's still an expensive preference. I don't know, if it's usually for people who have several $100,000 or more invested, they might be paying a few $1,000s a year in these fees, and this is a good way to get what in effect is a 10 to 30 or 40% break on those fees in the form of not paying taxes on it.
Let's go back to the phones now with Judy waiting in Milwaukee. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have two questions, but let me set the pace first. I'm a couple of years from mandatory takeouts from the couple of small IRAs that I do have. By the end of the month, I will be receiving a settlement for a lawsuit against workman's comp, and I want to put some away for savings. I'm going to do one major home repair, and I don't know which would be the best way, considering my age, to put something away for savings. And the other question is, I don't believe it is, but is this income taxable?
That's a good question. It depends on the type of settlement for it, and it actually relates into, you can't put money that you don't earn technically that's not taxable into an IRA. You have to have earnings or you have to be married to someone who has actual work-related earnings to make a contribution to an IRA. And then even then, you have to be under 70 and a half as well usually. Otherwise, you can only use a Roth IRA for contributions to that. So you'd have to check with get a CPA, because it sounds like you're in a good situation if you're getting some kind of settlement for it. But get a CPA. And do you have a lawyer, Judy, who's helping you through this, or is it part of a class action? The lawyer will be able to tell you then if the settlement is taxable, and then the CPA should be able to tell you if you can use it for a contribution to any type of retirement account. Again, I don't think you will be able to, but don't take my word for it. Pay someone a few $100 to give their opinion on it. And then the other thing, I think when you ask about the IRA, you're probably meaning, should I invest this in a mutual fund or the stock market or whatever, right?
Well, something like that, but I also considered CDs.
Yeah, I love CDs right now, especially for windfalls like this, whether it's $10,000 or $1 million. I'd much rather have people who get this kind of money just sit with it for a second and just take your breath, put it someplace safe. Yes, you might only earn 1% or 2% on it, even if you go out longer in a CD, but you're going to then have the money and be able, you've probably been going through lots of things with paperwork and taxes and things like that with this settlement, right?
Not this year.
Okay.
Not last year, just this year it will affect.
Okay. Well, and that's enough of the stress, and I don't believe that people should be investing if they can't focus on the process at hand as much as possible. So, yes, I'd like you to say just put it in a CD, talk with the people at the bank or credit union, see what they suggest. If you have a financial advisor, talk to him or her. Go scout out for one. The CPA might be able to offer a referral one as well. But go and then say, all right, I'm going to go for the long term here. And even then, in this environment, and if you don't need the growth, I'd like you to keep, you know, maybe a third to a half of that money in CDs at all time, because then it's there for you when you need it. And you don't have to worry about the volatility of stock-based investments really affecting the principal as much.
Judy, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Tony now in Madison. Hi, Tony. What's on your mind?
Hey, morning. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. I've been seeing a lot of their commercials, and I'm interested in getting a home loan. And I didn't know if that's a good way to get a loan or if you have any information on that. And I can take that answer off
sure.
the line.
Sure. Yeah, Tony, that's a great question, because they do advertise a lot. And what you'll find with these companies like this Rocket Mortgage or whatever, they're generally really efficient at what they do, but they're also usually more expensive than if you go to your own bank or credit union. So I don't mind you using a company like that to start out, but I would also go to your own bank or credit union, explain the situation for it. Those places like Rocket, Quicken, et cetera, they will get you through the system almost immediately. It's incredible. Sometimes I've gone, like I've said to clients, they said, well, they're going to get a mortgage. I'd say, well, try to get this. And they said, yeah, I went to the website. I clicked on the button to submit my little bit of information there, and I got a phone call within like 7 minutes. And it is really good service. It's a good machine. I've had experience dealing with them before, and I've been happy with it. It is more expensive in terms of points and fees that you pay, so you're paying for this good service than you would if you went to your local credit union or bank. A lot of people like to have the face-to-face conversation. If it takes a little longer, they're okay with it, and it might be less expensive. So I'd go to both places. It's generally not going to hurt your credit if you apply at two or three different places at the same time. It's not going to hurt it significantly. So, yeah, go to your local bank and then go to some other place and explain your situation and see what they say, and then see what the cost would be for getting the loan that you want.
Tony, good luck on the mortgage. You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is here with insights on your personal finance questions. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Send it off. The email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. Later this hour, with Earth Day on our mind, it's little positive things we can do to better the environment and save money at the same time. Stay with us for more On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. Improve the planet and your financial position all at once. Earth Day is around the corner, and you can save a lot of green and the environment with some small adjustments to your lifestyle. It is On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is keeping us in the know on our greenbacks. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question at 800-642-1234. Email onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go back to the phones now with Mary joining us from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Kevin. Thank you so much for this show. I've learned a lot.
You're welcome, Mary.
I hope you can help me with my this tough question. I'm going to retire next year when I'm 63. I'll need to have an additional $1,500 when I retire to keep my lifestyle going. should I take this money out of stocks and bonds, and then when I reach age 70, take my money out of Social Security, or take my money out of Social Security and then wait to take it out of the stocks and bonds?
Oh, Mary, thank you so much. This is such a simple question to answer. All I have to do to tell you exactly when you should take Social Security is to find out from you the exact date you're going to die. As long as you can give me that, I'll tell you just to the day, to the minute, when you should take Social Security. Mary, I have three different software programs that I run for my clients to say, when should we take Social Security? And almost every time we do it, it shakes out to, you tell me when you're going to die, and I'll tell you when to take Social Security. And as a rule of thumb, it's usually 80. If you live to age 80, waiting makes sense on paper. But And that's true whether you're saying, well, should I take it today or tomorrow, or should I take it at 63 or 70? But in your situation, I can say it depends a little bit more on what you would, where that money would come from. Like when you say the stocks and the bonds, is it in an IRA, or is it a Roth IRA, or is it just money you have in your own account outside of a retirement account?
No, I have a Roth IRA that I'm not going to touch at all.
Okay.
And this would be investments that I currently have.
Okay. So you kind of, for lack of a better word, you're probably spending principal and interest from that account, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, the good news is generally money from that source, you pay little or no taxes on it. So that's good news that you can pull it out. But the problem, of course, is that if that money, if you don't take that money and it otherwise declines in value, then you would have been better off pulling it from that out and letting Social Security go up. And a lot of people have the misunderstanding about Social Security. They say, well, if I wait a year, I make 8% on my money on Social Security by waiting. It's true that your payment can be 8% higher, meaning if you qualified for, let's say, $1,000 today and you waited a year, you would get $1,080. But the actual return on that is probably closer to 3 to 4% per year. So if you think you're going to earn better than 3 to 4% on your investments, over the future, you're probably better taking Social Security today. If you think you're not going to make it to 80, you're better off taking Social Security today. And even with that said, Mary, the median age at which people take Social Security, meaning half take it sooner and half take it later, is 63, your current age. And so half the people have already taken Social Security, even though they've only been eligible to receive it for a year. And some of that is because they want it and need it. Others because they say, I have enough money to live on, like you from other sources, but I've been told my whole life that Social Security is not going to be there, and I hear that it's going to run out in 2030, whatever. And so it's just going to feel good to have this new paycheck coming in, and then I can preserve my assets to do whatever I want with it. I can invest it, I can spend it, I can give it away, and it's still my money, and I get this new check coming in. And a lot of times when people are retiring, like you're doing, that first year is actually kind of stressful. You can't go on Facebook and complain about saying, hey, I'm not only not working, but I'm getting Social Security and I have enough money to live on, etc. You can't complain about that because nobody will sympathize with you. But it's still stressful for the first year or so. And having that extra check come in from Social Security, like clockwork every single month, can make you feel a little better and help replace the paycheck that you've given up from the earnings you've foregone by retiring.
Mary, thanks so much. Keep on living, though. Let's go to Patricia now in Portage. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. For years and years, I've been low income, and I was told by an accountant way back that I could take a loss carry forward. So for years, and I don't even know if there was a limit on that, but I would compile this loss carry forward list. And that's been going on for 25 years, so I have like maybe $130,000 in loss carry forward. Now I'm doing an Airbnb, and I actually have some income. So I'm wondering if there's a limit on how much loss carry forward I can take to balance any profits, and where do I log that into a tax statement?
Yeah, it depends a lot on the different kind of form. We won't get into that today, but there's no limit into how long you can carry forward capital losses. The only limit that you have is you have to take that loss amount and use it against any incurred capital gains in this year. Let's say, like you said, you've got $130,000. Let's say you had $10,000 in capital gains. Well, you'd have to work the $10,000 of losses against the gains. Now you're down to $120,000 for the subsequent years. Otherwise, you can, if you don't have any capital gains, you can use up to $3,000 of that loss carried forward each year and work it against ordinary income. So the loss can still save you maybe $500 to $1,000 in taxes by working it against income that would otherwise be taxable. And there is no limit to the time frame that you can keep carrying those losses forward. So hopefully you get to, you know, it's nice. It's too bad when it happens, but it's nice. You can usually work it in your favor by helping you lower your taxes in the subsequent years.
Well, good luck with that, Airbnb, Patricia. My mama told me you better shop around. Earth Day is coming up, and there are some little changes that we can make to our daily choices that will save us money while also save the environment.
Yes, there is. Sunday, April 22nd is Earth Day, Kate, and you can start by, this is something that I've tried to do myself around the house, avoiding disposables, especially things like paper towels and tissues. If you use rags or use a handkerchief or whatever, you can save a lot of money. America goes through 13 billion paper towels each year. They cost on average about half a penny, depending on the size and the quality, etc. And you would be better off just using the washcloth and the rag, which can cost anywhere from maybe 10 to 20 cents, depending on where you buy them. No, nobody ever goes out and buys rags. Everybody just has rags in the house, and nobody says
old
we're
t-shirts.
Out of rags. And
yeah.
T-shirts, wait, whatever it is there. It's usually old Wisconsin Public Radio premium items that have that have worn out over. But those only cost maybe 10 to 20 cents. And then the cost to wash them, depending again on your situation, probably works out to a penny to two pennies to wash it, actually. So not only are you probably saving money by not having to buy paper towels and tissues, but then even it avoids having to throw them away and having to dispose of them. So yeah, try to use a wash rag and a handkerchief rather than a paper towels and tissues.
All right. So what's the next piece of advice?
Switching to rechargeable batteries. We use about 3 billion batteries in America every single year, and that's about 27 per household. And Kate, I know you have kids, and kids exponentially up the amount of batteries you use in a particular year. They cost about 75 cents each. On that average, it's only about $20. But what's a much bigger issue is throwing them away, because many batteries contain heavy metals, which are very bad for the environment, and these batteries last forever sitting in the landfill for it. So get a rechargeable one. You'll pay about $20 up front. And if you cycle through the rechargeable about five or six times, depending on the price you pay, you'll already have paid for the recharge unit and the batteries. And then even if you need to buy extra batteries in the future, many of them are guaranteed to last 5 to 10 years. But if you do need to buy batteries, you already have the charger. And so that's a one less cost to deal with.
And last but not least,
switch to drinking tap water. This is the number one thing people can do to not only save money, but to help the environment and lose weight. We've done, remember, Kate, last year we did a whole section on the cost of beverages, all
yep.
the different kinds. And what we worked out to, it cost about 50 cents a serving. And that is true across the board, whether it's milk or beer, even wine or soda. So at 50 cents a serving, at three meals a day, if you switch to water, tap water, that saves you $1.50. Times 365 days is about $500 a year. And not only does that save you some money, $500 a year, but it also means there's a bunch of containers that don't need to be shipped to the supermarket or the convenience store, and then you need to use and then get rid of and try to recycle for it. But you will lose weight. Let's just say that each one of those beverages you were drinking three times a day was 150 calories. Over a year, if you cut that out completely, 450 calories a day, that's a pound a week that you could lose if your diet and exercise otherwise remain the same. So you could lose dozens of pounds while you're saving $500 a year and saving the environment.
And if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, there's still time for you at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jill now, who is waiting for us in Southern Alabama. Hi, Jill.
Hi there. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Kate. My question is that I'm enjoying my retirement. I'm 66 years old, and while I'm in Alabama right now, I'm a resident of Illinois. I knew better than to be there this past winter. And so I'm living on my Social Security, and I get $500 a month out of my investments. So I have a very minimal income. Do I need to submit an income tax return?
Are you single, Jill? And I'm not asking
No, that's quite all right.
Okay, all right. It's not
single. It's just myself.
Okay, good. I do most of my dating offline from the show, online.
You
good. I appreciate that. If you're under 65 and single, you have to file a tax return if you earn $10,400 or more. That's the sum of the 2017 standard deduction for a single taxpayer plus one exemption for it. Now, if you're older than 65 and you just received Social Security, you're still subject to the same requirements, but you have to watch out because you might receive more income during the year because than other taxpayers across the year for it, and you obviously don't have dependents either, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, I would say that you don't have to file it based on the limited information that we have, but you might want to do it anyway because sometimes people, when they do file, they find that they don't owe any taxes, but they had withholding during the year from various sources that they forgot about, and that can come back to them in the form of a refund. And I've had several stories over the time when people have called in and said, you know, all the years I didn't file taxes because my income wasn't high enough, but I noticed that some entity, whether it's Social Security, a pension, distribution from an IRA, a mutual fund, whatever, withheld the taxes. It cost me $50 to do my taxes, but I got a $250 refund back on money that I forgot that I had. So you may want to consider doing it anyway, just to see if there was money out there that you missed. But you sound like you're kind of on the ball, so I doubt that that's the case.
Well, Jill, Gulf Shore is so beautiful, but don't forget to come back and visit us sometime. And Kevin, what is the website of the week?
Well, we've been talking about remembering to do your taxes. Another thing that you can do that will save you money and save the earth is change your filters to your furnace every single month, winter and summer, for it not only gets cleaner air in through you, to your house, but it also means that the units have to work harder and they use less energy and are less likely to wear out. To remember to do these things like change your filters and pay your taxes, there's an app out that's really great. I've just gotten into this and I'm still learning it, but it's called Notion. And there's a version you can use that's low cost. There's a higher cost one they're coming out with. But Notion is just a really great productivity manager for it. And we'll have a link to the iTunes store for Notion, and it'll help you remember to do all these things and hopefully organize your life as well.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8, rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. And this edition of On Your Money was produced by Colleen Leahy and Brianne Chasso. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is our executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.